And that's the theme from Tales from the Crypt, the TV show on HBO a few years back. The source material for it comes from a comic book. And comic books, including Tales from the Crypt, are the subject of this hour of the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jim Meadows, taking over for this hour of Afternoon Magazine from Celeste Quinn. Henry Frain is our technical director. And our guest today is someone who was on this show back in 2001. Back then, he was talking about his book, Positively Fourth Street, about Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, and Mimi and Richard Ferenya. Now, David Haytou is writing about comic books in the 10-cent plague, the great comic book scare, and how it changed America. And David, welcome back to the Afternoon Magazine.
Jim, it's nice of you to have me back. It's hard to believe it's 7 years. I'm going to have to write my books a little faster so we could talk more often.
Well, I'll tell you, the 10-cent plague looks like it could have taken 7 years to write. There's an impressive amount of research. You talked to an awful lot of people.
Thanks.
For this slice of comic book history.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I did. I talked to over 150 comic book artists and writers who were involved in comics since the very earliest days of the medium, since the mid-1930s, and also did a lot of archival research. I was stunned to find how much archival research I had to do, because I didn't know that there were hundreds upon hundreds of articles about the controversy that the book is about. And I don't know when you want to talk about that, but I went in thinking I was telling I wasn't even sure if there would be a book in it. I thought I might be writing an article about the little to-do that there was about comic books in the 1950s. I didn't know until I started doing the research that the controversy about comics started so much earlier, and it was much bigger, and that it was a full-blown hysteria and that took place over the course of decades.
Well, to set the stage here, of course, comic books permeate our pop culture today. Kids may not see comic books on the newsstands like they used to. They're more of a specialty item now. But in the period that you write about, mostly, I think, the post-war era from the late 1940s into the mid-1950s, comic books were really big.
Well, comic books essentially were popular culture for a brief period, and it's largely forgotten. It's kind of parallel to jazz. I think a lot about jazz and write about it. You know, we think about jazz as kind of specialty music for a group of aficionados, but there was a time when it was the most popular music in America. And comic books in the late 1940s and 50s sold somewhere between 60 and 100 million copies every week. Now, that's an awful lot. And then those comics weren't just read today comics aren't even, I mean, in many cases aren't even read. They're collected. I mean, often read, but sometimes, too, it's put in slip cases and saved to accrue value. But in these days, comics were more popular, excuse me, than movies, than television. Television was just on the rise. Movies were a bit on decline, more popular than radio, which is kind of beginning to decline also at this point, and more popular than mainstream magazines. And if you were young, you read comic books, and comic books reached more people than any other kind of entertainment. And they weren't the kind of comics we think of today. And I think that's one of the reasons that they were as popular as they were. I mean, we think of comics now. I have three kids myself, and I mean, the comics that my kids read are superhero comics. But the most popular comics in these days weren't superhero. Superhero comics existed, but they were in decline too, and they were replaced by the other genres of dark, noirish comics centered on crime and horror and lust. And these are the comics that caught the attention of not only kids, but of parents who grew concerned about what their kids were reading.
Now, this brings up a question. Who really read these comic books, and especially perhaps the darker material? These were, you know, there were the superhero comics, there were the funny animal, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck sort of comic books, and there were also things as you talked about, like Tales from the Crypt and Crime Does Not Pay,
mm-hmm.
which were about grown-ups doing hideously grown-up things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Were they only read by children?
No, that's a good question, and that's one of the things we have to, you know, when we try to come to terms with this set of events that I'm writing about, which is mainstream entertainment gone dark and inciting a hysteria that engaged the entire country. I mean, how can that be? It was because comic books weren't what we think of today. They were read by everybody. Up to, when I would say everybody, I mean boys, girls, kids, adolescents, up to the people in their early 20s. What happened was this: that during the war, GIs read comics. And they were shipped overseas for comics for GIs to read. Meanwhile, here in stateside, at the same time, the comic book audience, the kids who grew up with comics in the 30s were starting to grow older, and comic book artists and writers and publishers made stories that appealed to older and older readers on the assumption that comic readers would continue to read comics, and the comics therefore had to respond to this, to the aging of the audience, of the readers. And so there wasn't the perception that there was today that comics is something that only kids read. Comics writers and artists tailored them to older and older people, and they took them into the realm of noir films. In fact, they were often more gruesome and more violent than noir films were in the 1940s, and in full color, but reached, because they were on newsstands, they were able to reach not only this older kids, but also young people. And that's one of the reasons that they became so controversial. And anybody of any age had access to them. And the very young were buying them, as well as people in their teens and their early 20s.
Now, I want to see if I can figure out the context here, because pulp magazines also existed in a big way about this same period. I think they both had the same sort of economic and distribution model, mm-hmm. and some pulp publishers also published comic books like Street and Smith and Ziff Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Which was bigger, and did they have an overlap in their audience?
There was a bit of an overlap in their audience, and people in their early 20s, but not as much as you'd think. For the most part, full-blown adults read pulp magazine, people in their 20s and 30s and younger, slightly more younger people read comics. The real distinction between the two was one along class lines, in that for the most part, pulp magazines tended to attract, middle-class, working-class reader by design. I mean, it wasn't that they were sought and engaged that readership. And comic books, all kids read comic books, and comic books cross class lines. So, debutantes and outsiders and scholars and athletes and, young people of all kinds and GIs and college students were all reading comics in those days. So one of the distinctions is really a class distinction, and the other distinction is that, yes, older people were reading pulp magazines. Another distinction is that so many more people were reading comics. Comics were reaching all young people, and pulp magazines weren't.
Now, let's see if we can go into some of the content. And you talked about the main genres that bothered people, which were crime and horror.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like what was sort of the leader in the crime genre was the book Crime Does Not Pay,
mm-hmm.
which was published for several years. And I believe the big name involved behind that was a guy named Lev Gleason.
Lev Gleason was a publisher, also was an advocate of progressive causes, and he published some leftist publications for adults at the same time. His editors were a pair of jobbers, that not not terribly gifted as artists named Charles Biro and Bob Wood. And they, Biro took credit for inventing the crime genre in comics. Something about the comics form induced people to take credit for things that they probably didn't have any right to take credit for. But the main editor and artist of the line that was more responsible than any other comics line for the explosion in crime comics was this fellow named Charles Biro. And his what Crime Did Does Not Pay did, and this is really key to the reaction against comics and the anti-comics sentiment and what became a full-blown crusade against comics. What Biro did was he did not focus on crime fighting or on solving crimes the way that comics traditionally did or detective magazines did. He flipped things around, and the stories focused on the lives of the criminals. So there'd be a six-page story that would be the life story of a serial murderer or an extortionist or sadist. Like, there was a story I describe in the book called The Wild Spree of the Laughing Sadist. And for six pages, it's the life story of this kid who grew up, you know, killing the, you know, animals and the family pets and the birds in the backyard, and grew to be this, you know, unremitting, you know, unapologetic sadist. In the very end, there's, you know, his kind of comeuppance and inevitable punishment. But it's kind of a token thing that's just tacked on in the end, and it takes place over the course of literally two panels in the end of a six-page story. So what kids are getting is the stories that bring you into the mind of the wrongdoers, of the criminals. And we could see just from this description what's thorny about that, you know.
And when you look at the books yourselves, and you know, you're a guy with kids, do you think, would you feel comfortable having your kids look at that stuff?
No, I look at that. I'm not comfortable looking at it myself, some of it. I tried in the book to do justice to the multiple points of view and this hysteria over comics and to both sides in the issue. And on one hand, I'm not quite a free speech purist, but my sympathies incline to the free speech side, and you know, resist censorship nearly all costs. So on one hand, I'm thinking, well, you know, this is America. These artists are expressing something that they feel is legitimate, and it's defensible on certain grounds. That, now I'm going to get to your question. Bear with me a second, because I really want to do justice to both sides of this. I mean, on the one side, you could argue that, I mean, you could go back to St. Augustine and argue that we need to confront the presence of evil. We need to confront evil to understand the imperative of good. And, you know, there's Satan is in the Bible, and we need. So you could argue that only by confronting, like, horrors at their worst, do we understand the necessity for good, for people to behave at their best. I mean, that's arguable. And you could also argue that this is a release valve that's of value to young people who are trying to come to terms with the adult world and are wrestling with issues of good and bad. And that's a defensible point of view, too. But then there's something on the other side, and as a parent, you know, this is where I could understand the point of view of the anti-comics crusade, when there's a kind of extremism in some of these comics. There was a kind of violence that really was excessively graphic, in color, and available to kids. And the treatment of the violence was too gleeful sometimes. So it reminds me of video games in a way. You know, I really can see both sides of this.
And there was competition too. There were like maybe a dozen or two comic book publishers all trying to top themselves, and they were they knew this stuff sold.
That's right. Well, that's thank you. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's really the point. I mean, crime does not pay, and the second comic that Bureau and Wood published, Crime and Punishment, went pretty far with stories like the Wild Spear, the Laughing Status. But this escalation of violence began, and the comics publishers were trying to trump each other, and you know, the race became one of who can top the other each week, because the competition was intense, it was furious in the newsstands. And comics publishers, like a fellow named Stanley P. Morse, who's, by the way, still alive and living in New York, and you know, unrepentant 60 years later, came along with the most gruesome comics you can imagine, with brains spilling out. I don't know about if you could, I mean, most gruesome comics I can imagine. I'm not trying to accuse you of being more gruesome than me, but but brains spilling out of heads, and just sadism again, necrophilia. I mean, really kind of unspeakable horrors.
And these were things that people could never see in the movies. Well, they could see them in the movies now, but they could never see them back at that time.
Well, there was nothing like this in movies in those days. Not this visually graphic, you know, not this graphic. Two, not in color. Three, they're drawings, they're not photographs, so from one point of view, you could say they're not as realistic as photographs. But because they were drawings, they had the artists were able to bring a point of view to the work and that point of view was often gleeful. There was a sense of play at the work, and there's a kind of euphoria in some of the depictions of violence, and they came out in part because through the artwork, because they were drawings. And another side of this is that they were available to young people. So as a result, because of all this, the country absolutely parents became concerned, civic leaders became concerned, PTAs, the American Legion, and church groups, other watchdog organizations, and municipal leaders. And by the late 1940s and early 1950s, actually, you know what? By 60 years ago this year, because this is 2008, so in 1948, there were nearly 50 pieces of legislation in cities around the country focused on crime comics, not even horror comics yet, just crime comics, and making them illegal or restricting the sale of crime comics. For a while, crime comics were illegal in the county of Los Angeles, and in fact, one news dealer was arrested for selling a copy of Crime Does Not Pay. And within a few years, there were over 100 pieces of legislation restricting the sale of comics, and public burnings that took place over a period of 10 years. From 1945, right, a few months after the end of World War II, to 1955, over a period of 10 years, there were dozens of ritual bonfires, burnings of comic books all around the country. So this controversy is raged throughout the entire country for a decade.
Well, let me hold on to that thread of the narrative as we talk about the amazing popularity of comic books at that point, and the very strong backlash against the violence and crime comic books. We're talking with David Haidu here in the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare and How It Changed America. We have a caller who's been waiting patiently on line one from Champaign. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Thank you. Does your examination limit itself just to the United States in the 1950s, or do you go back into the early roots of comic books and foreign influences, that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. The book starts with comic strips of the turn of the last century, and the opening section is foreshadows the controversy over comic books by showing how controversial comic strips were in the era of the Pulitzer and Hearst newspapers and 100 years ago now. It doesn't deal much with It deals a bit with the influence on comics, but because I'm focused on how comics were, the debate over comics, the deep aesthetic roots of comics are not part of the terrain of the book. There are two good books on the international dimensions of the comic controversy, by the way, written by others. There's a good book on how these issues played out in the UK and Canada, called A Haunt of Fears, and then there's another book on the international dimension of comics and called Pulp Demons. And I recommend both of them. I didn't write them. I don't get commissioned, but they're very good, and I recommend them both.
Well, as you probably know, you know, there are deep roots in Asia, and probably I think you could easily argue that the comic book is a Japanese creation.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, the term manga had already been coined by the early 1800s, and there are examples of, you know, what is essentially, you know, early comic books that go back into the you know, early 1700s, late 1600s in Japan, and they have their roots even earlier back over 1,000 years ago in Chinese animal scrolls, where they would have, you know, animal characters mm-hmm. acting essentially as humans mm-hmm. and, you know, acting all kinds of things out. And mm-hmm. And certainly there were, you know, lots of violence and mm-hmm. sex and things like that in those precursors of...
Can I ask you a question? I'm curious about
sure.
why do you think there wasn't a controversy, a public debate on this in those in Asian cultures in the same level that there was in Western cultures? Why did comics incite the kind of hysteria in Japan that they did in America and in the UK? What do you think?
Well, they actually went through periods of censorship there as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of diversification mm-hmm. in it. They are marketed to, you know, a lot of narrow constituencies. In other words, I mean, it's like every age group and every, you know, sort of interest mm-hmm. and gender has their own genres of mangas and comics, and many of them are, you know, in book form that, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages mm-hmm. long, even, as well as shorter ones. So, I mean, you know, that's a very pretty complex subject, you know, mm-hmm. because and there were imperial censors that censored things, but then there was always you know, some things that were, you know, privately held and distributed that mm-hmm. you know, weren't subject to censorship, you know, in some part mm-hmm. because they were going to people who were the censors.
I mean, censorship or regulation, whether it's imposed by the institutions that are charged with protecting the populace or you're maintaining the ethical and moral values of the society,
as well as
are one thing, and we have them with the FCC, and we have them with the Hollywood, first with the Hays Office, and now with the movie rating system. But a full-blown hysteria in the country, like we had with comic books and like we had during the McCarthy era with the Hollywood 10 and the Red Scare, is another thing. And why this happened in why this did not happen in other countries and it happened in America is a subject that really intrigues me. The public seemed to have made peace with comics much earlier in other countries, and maybe it's specifically in Asian cultures, and maybe it's because they have such deep roots. I'm thinking that it's possible that they didn't carry with them the association of a new rising generation the way the comic books did here. I mean, in the 1940s, adults associated comics with young people of the time. So they didn't think of comic books as something that was historically rooted in the culture. So it seemed more threatening.
Well, that's one thing I would say is different, is that there are different kinds of, you know, comics marketed to every, you know, strata and and group in Japanese society. It's, you know, it's much more diverse than it is here.
That's an interesting conversation. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, caller, for your comments and insights. We're talking with David Haidu, author of The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare, and How It Changed America. And if you have memories of reading these comic books, specifically the crime and horror comic books of the late 1940s and early 1950s, please give us a call at 333-9455 or call our toll-free number if you're out of town, 800-222-9455. You were talking about the backlash and about the laws passed against comic books, the organized campaigns that actually included public burnings of comic books.
Mm-hmm.
But right, the comic books held on for some years after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the comic books. I'm sorry, Jim. What did you say? The comic books. What?
They held on. The comic books, the crime and the horror comic books continued to be published and continued to sell. Why did these efforts not work?
Well, I think they did work. They hung on for a while until the public, while simultaneously the sentiment against comics increased. But it wasn't. What happened was the original debate against. Crime. I mean, the original debate. Well, it's so complicated. Somebody should write a whole book about it. You know? The campaign against comics. There wasn't just a single campaign against comics. That's probably the best way to put it. Various protectors of various. Ideals and principles and sets of values objected to comics for differing grounds at various times. The original critics of comics were protectors of traditional kinds of children's books. There was a fellow named Sterling North who in 1940 wrote a rant against comics, by the way, published in Chicago, by the way. He was a columnist for one of the Chicago papers, not the Tribune, and wrote children's books. And his objection to comics was that comic books induced illiteracy and were bad for the eyes. Not long after that, church groups criticized comics for being blasphemous because the heroes were endowed with supernatural powers. Superheroes were superhuman, and that was blasphemous. Then, when crime comics came along, comics were associated with juvenile delinquency. Then, romance comics came along, and they encouraged kind of freedom, a free approach to sex, and a laxity of what was perceived of as a laxity in moral values that seemed to threaten young womanhood. At the time, and there was legislation, and there were community groups focused specifically at romance comics for their supposed moral laxity. Then horror comics came along, and horror comics again were connected to juvenile delinquency. At one point, comic books were accused of being fascist. Another point, they were accused of being communist. So really, what was going on was one generation seeing. Sensibility in comics, as well as an extremism that it just couldn't come to terms with or figure out. It just didn't seem right. And this was happening at the same time that kids seemed to be darkening and engaging in more and more kinds of unacceptable behavior, you know, that we now which was pathologized at the time as juvenile delinquency. The kids seemed to be darkening, and kids seemed to be more attracted to and naughtiness, you know, kids were changing, and parents were struggling to find a cause, to identify a cause for it, and to do something about what the state of young people, and they latched onto comics, and I don't think they were entirely wrong, but they were mostly wrong.
We have a caller on line one from Urbana. Let's go to that caller. Good afternoon. You're on the air on the Afternoon Magazine.
Hi there. Nice show. Thanks for having it. I'm interested in, perhaps you're talking a bit about the Marvel-DC difference about the time that the Fantastic Four came out. I say that because I gained my vocabulary from Marvel Comics much more than from school at that time. And the writing was sophisticated and it was humanist. We definitely had a rise in the sophistication of how we looked at morals and what if we added this in or added that in. And as you say, the art changed and became not only much more lifelike in the drawing of the characters compared to DC, but the language changed substantially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess there's a whole school of thought that Stan Lee is the Sartre of comics, and the comics group became existential under Stan Lee in the early 1960s. You know, that's a little outside of my area of expertise because my book and my study focuses on the period from the 30s to the mid 1950s, and it doesn't. And I don't really deal much with superheroes because superheroes were in decline, and this whole other these other genres of crime and horror and romance comics came up. So, and the book ends in the mid 1950s with the imposition of the Comics Code and the near death of the comics industry. So what you're talking about is the way that comics sort of came back and came back as something different in the early 60s. And it's interesting that when they did come up, they had a different identity, mm-hmm. and that they were thoughtful.
Well, they had Marvel, for instance, had a couple that had come through, like Sergeant Rock.
Mm-hmm. That was DC, I think.
Sergeant Rock was?
I think, yeah.
I'll let you go. I'll
okay.
let you have it.
But no, this is your area more than mine. I ended in 1955. So.
And you're probably correct, though. And they had Captain America, who they had killed off because they didn't. It was no longer of interest mm-hmm. when they brought the superheroes back. So they started killing off their war comic heroes mm-hmm. and bringing in more of the superhero.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At any rate, I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
No, thank you so much.
Thank you, caller. And that is something to think of, that the comic books that have generated so much nostalgia now and also generates other media, the TV shows and movies we see about them now, come sort of from the ashes of the era of comics that you write about in the 10-Cent Plague.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. The comic book industry nearly died, nearly collapsed, and comics as an art form even more like overtly than the comics as a business. I mean, some comics were still published after the mid 1950s, but the ones that were published in the years immediately after the big crackdown on comics were gelded. They were neutered. They were mostly kind of juvenile comics and talking animals again or. Very radically softened and sweetened superhero comics. And it took a long time for comics to return and to regain their bite. And when they did, they never, enough for a long time, became, took some time for them to become a major, be a major presence in American popular culture again, and they never again became the single most popular form of entertainment in America. They never did. You know, there's something happened with this crackdown that, we're talking about comics recovering, but so many of the artists and writers who suffered under the crackdown in the early 1950s, so many of them never recovered at all. And I went back and made a grassroots study of the artists who were working in comics in the 30s and 40s, and how many, and I identified by name the artists who were never again published after the crackdown of comics, and there were over 800 artists.
It's an amazing list that you have at the end of the book of these people who never worked in the industry again.
You know, I had
the crackdown.
Yeah, I had quite a bit of help doing it. In fact, there was a comic book scholar, just a dear guy who's gone now. He died a couple of years ago, named Jerry Bales. And he developed an original software program to help me do it. And then I had a couple of other researchers doing it. And it took years to do. And when I was stunned when I found out. Because what I had done is I interviewed some people who had been involved with comics in the 40s and 50s and who weren't published anymore. And Mort Lev, for instance, who was a wonderful artist, and he never went into comics, and a woman named Janice Velou. And they, each one of them gave me a couple more names, and they said, you know, such and such became a postal worker, such and such became worked for the police department, and radio dispatcher.
They weren't doing any sort of commercial illustration or artwork at all.
No.
Well, many of these people.
Well, many of them, some went into other aspects of art, but then over 800 never made comic books, never worked in comic books again, and a great many never made art again. And they felt so wounded by this, by the crackdown, because the word plague in the title has two meanings, and we've been talking so far mainly about the one meaning of the word plague, is the way that parents and adults and the authorities looked at comics as a contagion, as something that was insidious, that was affecting young people. But when the purge came and the clampdown came, it was a parallel to McCarthyism and a parallel to the Red Scare. The comic book artists thought that they were suffering under a plague. And they were driven, and again, hundreds of them were driven out of work. And I interviewed quite a few who 50, 60 years later still felt wounded because they felt they took pride in what they were doing. They thought of comics as an art form that had value, and nobody was talking about comics the way that they talk about comics today. As you know, there weren't museum shows devoted to comic books, and there weren't books written about comics as a great American vernacular art form the way that there are today. And I mean, these people were considered something close to tantamount to criminals in those days. I mean, Will Eisner said, if you said that you were a comic book artist, it's like saying you were a child molester. The public had conflated kind of corrupting youth and violating youth with the comic book art. It was a terrible thing.
Let me go over to another patient caller on line two. This is a caller from Urbana. And good afternoon. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm very glad I've had a chance to catch the show. The period from late 1930s to early 1950s has always fascinated me as well. I'm a collector and a dealer, and Sergeant Rock is definitely from the DC publications. And during my college days, I'd written a couple of papers, one in regard to the rise of feminism juxtaposed to the treatment of women in comic books, particularly early 1950s, and also racial stereotyping and the use of propaganda in comics during the 1940s, during the war years. And I look forward to reading your book and wondering if you have any comments on those two particular subjects.
Yeah, they're very, very good questions. One is has to do with the roles of women in comics. Have you looked much into romance comics? I have a full chapter on romance comics in the book, because we think of romance comics, our conception of romance comics is framed by those Lichtenstein panels, and romance comics were hugely popular in the early 1950s, and many of them were very overt in their depiction of young people who were challenging the status quo. I mean, young women who were defying their parents and defying men, defying boys, young women who were defying all the rules. They weren't just kind of weak, weepy, love-torn girls in the romance comics of the early 50s. So there's more to that genre than you might think. Racial stereotyping was horrible, especially against Asian Americans, but there were also Asian Americans working in comics. Bob Fujitani, Fred Keita, were both Asian Americans drawing crime comics and horror comics, and there were African Americans drawing comics, and a great many more than you might realize. In fact, the artist who did the first graphic novel, Matt Baker,
published in the 1950s was African American. So, you know, in the case of Baker's work and Fujitani's work and Kida's work and some others, there's a kind of inclusiveness that you might not find in other comics. Let me add one more thought. You must have seen the Harvey Kurtzman so-called war comics that were done by EC in the early 50s, but they were really anti-war comics. And it's stunning to go back and look at them and see the way that they portrayed the Korean War, because Kurtzman never demonized the North Koreans and never demonized Asians in these comics in the 50s. Critically, you know, a lot of comics during the war did, but this line did not. So you find kind of odd pockets of enlightenment, you know, in comics, and you know, and also stereotyping too. It's a very complicated subject.
I want to thank the caller for asking that question. We're almost out of time here on the Afternoon Magazine, and I'm going to squeeze in. There's so much we could cover here, but I'm going to squeeze in one more caller to see if we can make this quick. Line one from Champaign. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Just a piggybacking, it's the very same thing I was going to mention, the impact of the war on the family. Mm-hmm. The women going into the workplace of industry and, of course, teenagers rebelling in the home.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thought entered my mind in regard to the impact of the war on the very fabric of the psyche in America.
It's a very, very good point. I give that a lot of attention. There, as you no doubt know, I could tell by your comments that there are spikes in law breaking among young people during wartime, historically, and it occurred in this country during World War II and in other countries during World War II. It occurred in this country during World War I also. And the public was made aware of this through a film, a Time Life film called Youth in Crisis. There was a big breakthrough in public awareness of the rise of juvenile crime in this country during the war. And the focus of the film, like a focus of some scholarly writing at the time, was on the breakup of the family during wartime. Because there was no father figures, well, you know, all the obvious things, and the kids were therefore running wild. But this notion then had a kind of romantic allure to young people at the same time, so it became self-fulfilling, you know. And then the romantic allure was reinforced in the popular culture at the time, and not only by comic books, but in movies like The Wild One, the Marlon Brando movie. So you have this odd, utterly American cycle of both of social events and societal events entwined with the portrayal of those events in popular culture, kind of escalating things and kind of mixing all things up. And I give that quite a bit of attention in the book.
And I have to say that right now we are just about out of time. There are so many areas we haven't had a chance to cover. We haven't even mentioned, for instance, William Gaines, the publisher of the EC Horror Comics, Are Frederick Wortham, a very interesting man who was one of the leading crusaders against comic books.
Well, Jim, you're just going to have me back when the paperback is published.
Okay.
It's going to be a year from now, but yeah.
I can't wait.
There's a good guy and a bad guy in the book, and I tried not to make it that simple, but Gaines is the good guy, and Wortham is sort of kind of the bad guy, although, you know, I tried not to demonize him.
Well, perhaps we can wait till the comic book adaptation comes out. The book is The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare, and How It Changed America. It's published by Ferrell, Straus, and Giroux, and it's out now. And David Haidu, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me about it.
Oh, I love this. Thanks a lot, Jim.